Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
All right, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. Drew, how are you doing today?
Doing well. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. I like to location stamp our recordings. So I am recording from Chicago today, and you are dialing in from?
Austin, Texas. Although I used to live in Chicago, so I moved just two months ago. So getting used to the difference here. Because, yeah, we were probably lived 2-3 miles away from each other until real recently. So.
Did our wonderful Chicago winters have anything to do with that?
Yeah, I think it was really it's more the safety and the property taxes is what got me motivated to move, where it just was one thing sort of after another. And you know, like Chicago was really, you know, it's really a great city, you know, in a lot of aspects, like it's world class, you know, in line with, you know, a New York or London or Paris kind of conversation. But it's just, it's, you know, I have a 5-year-old son, and it was just kind of exhausting just worrying about everybody's safety. And then I had someone I knew, a friend of his, got kidnapped and driven around from ATM to ATM, and just kind of was, you know, just one thing after another. So,
wow.
Yeah. So,
all right.
But I it's going to be fun to visit and know the city well. And I still own a dozen plus buildings there, and, you know, they're having a great last couple of years where rents have really ran up. There hasn't been that much new supply. So they've performed really well. Not all negative. So just.
Yeah, I love Chicago personally for the rental apartments that I own. I think Chicago is understated in the national investment context when we talk about apartment buildings, although I don't necessarily know that would hold true, like when we get into the main topic here of the size of deal that you are focusing on now. I think it probably is a good market, and I'm not super familiar with, let's say, 20, 30, 40 units and up in the city of Chicago. But one unique thing, we do deals in Atlanta, Chicago, Philly, around the country, Florida, a lot of other markets as well. And the one thing I found and love about the Chicago market specifically, Drew, is the abundance of 2, 3, and 4 flat buildings. So like I found no other market. I mean, maybe Los Angeles or New York offers that kind of opportunity to the, call it the entry level investor, to get the 2 or the 3 or the 4 unit buildings and kind of do the house hacking. So I've loved this city for that result. And when I got here, moved here from Philadelphia in 2015 to Chicago, I was blown away by they were high prices in areas that, where I came from in Philly, we have very, very low prices comparatively of maybe people who are making the same kind of money in Philadelphia can buy a much lower cost house in the city. And then the prices were probably almost double in Chicago. Wow. So we have like expensive real estate and high rents. And my theory, philosophy, investment philosophy, buying those apartment units over the past couple of years has been, I want to get in to the expensive property and take out, I don't want to overpay, but I want to take out a higher and higher mortgage with higher and higher rents on a per unit basis, because I'm paying down debt at a like higher velocity over time. And then the 2.5% increases are like, they're larger dollars. So it allowed me to play a little bit bigger than I might've been able to play in the city of Philadelphia. And there's just such an abundance of that type of inventory. Whereas in Philadelphia or in a lot of other cities, you know, Atlanta, having a duplex or a triplex is like, it's a unicorn. It's a really rare event. But I digress on that. Why don't we, for listeners, Drew, why don't you kind of do our evolution of the business model and your origination story so we can get a picture of who you are and what your business looks like?
Sounds great. And I've had the same, I've noticed the same thing about Chicago, where, yeah, that's, if you wanted to get started in a 2-4 unit, there might be more there than anywhere. Because I often give that advice for someone starting out. And one of the people I was talking to was in Phoenix, and he was like, there's no 3 units here. What are you talking about? So, and I was like, well, you gotta figure out where they are. I'm sure there's some, but that anyways. Yeah. So got started really young. So I started a from the Milwaukee area, and both my parents were teachers, was living out in the suburbs my whole childhood. And I started a business online, just buying and selling items and video games. And, you know, it was just not any, it didn't make any huge money on any one sale, but, you know, I made $5 or $10 per sale. And I saved all the money. So for whatever reason, that was sort of my natural instinct and still is, where I want to save and sort of defer and grow something bigger. So I just started doing that immediately. And then over the course of basically a 4-year period, I made between $80,000 and $100,000 as a high schooler. And then in my freshman year of college, in total, I saved it all. During that time, I started reading all these investing books that people probably read normally when they're like in their 40s, like Rich Dad, Poor Dad and Intelligent Investor. I did a book report on Think and Grow Rich. So I started out just how everybody does. I started investing in the stock market and stocks and mutual funds and mutual funds that my dad recommended, and just sort of did the usual thing. And maybe fortunately for me, like, that was a down year in the market, or at least was not a down period when I was investing. You know, so this was probably in like 2002, because I graduated high school in 2004. So it was 2002, probably 2003 summer. I'm investing, and, you know, the market, I wasn't making any money in it. And so I would like to go back if I could and see how tight this time window was, because it might have been like a 2-month period where I was just like, yeah, I don't like this. This doesn't, I have no control and it's not going up and there's no, I have like no advantage in this thing. So let me see what else there is. And so I did. I read a bunch of books and on different businesses, vending machines and different things you could do. And I really liked where the light bulb went off for me with real estate was in a book called Investing in Real Estate by Gary Eldred. So it's a basic book. It basically takes you from not knowing anything about real estate to just getting into how do these deals work and property management tips and how to pick a realtor. I think like very from the, you know, ground level, you know, not an advanced book. So perfect for me. And the light bulb moment for me was really when they started talking about the appreciation of the properties and how that works when you also have when you lever it up with the mortgage. So they're explaining the cash flow, which I understood, and that you pay your loan down over time. So like those were two ways you make money. Then the third way was the appreciation, which that's everyone knows that, but it's when the price goes up. But what was the light bulb moment was he had an example where it was you put 10% down on a duplex. And then let's say that goes up 3% a year on your 10% down payment, that appreciation is a 30% return per year. So then not even including cash flow or paying the loan down. And once you do, you know, more deals, you realize this is oversimplified. You know, not every property goes up 3% a year. You know, sometimes they go up more, sometimes they go down, sometimes they don't. There's no change in value. Sometimes you do things to the property, make it worth more or make it worth less, you know, if you make a mistake. But it's very simplified, but it made a lot of sense to me, where I was like, hey, this is combining essentially like a business with an investment. I don't have to go create something, you know. Or the other thing that was really popular was opening these, like the Subway restaurants were just exploding everywhere at that point. So like that was something I got one of the, you know, franchisee packets about and was reading. And that seemed really pretty hard compared to real estate investing, you know, running a restaurant or a quick service food place, right? So seemed pretty simple. You know, you get a couple, you know, a building with a couple units in it, rent it out. You have a signed contract for the rent. You get a call every now and then, like seemed like something I'd want to do. And so I thought, all right, I'm going to go to college next year at UW-Madison. And when I get in my freshman year, I'll buy a place, I'll buy a duplex or 3-unit, and then I'll live in it my sophomore year and beyond, and rent out the other units and rent out the rooms in my unit to friends of mine. And so I did that. So yeah, when I was 19, I bought my first deal as a freshman, bought a duplex in Madison. For $220,000, put 15% down, 30 something thousand, I think 35-ish, and then rented out the upstairs unit and moved into one of the bedrooms in the downstairs one, and rented out the other two bedrooms to my two friends, and then it was just kind of off and going. Ended up buying 3 deals additional while I was in school, so I bought 4 deals total in Madison. Really, with all sort of that initial money that I made with the internet business, then also reinvesting the profits. Like I bought two deals, then I sold the first one and used that money to buy the third, and just kind of did it that way, just building the snowball of sorts. But then when I graduated, it was 2007, and I didn't really, I don't know if I ever even heard of somebody like getting investors, even though I had a real estate degree at this point. So yeah, I graduated, but that was more how to underwrite, how to do like, you know, big deals and how does this all work, but not so much about like raising capital or running a business. But anyways, I thought like the next thing I should do is I should go work at a big company and maybe learn what they're all doing. The market looks pretty bad anyways right now. It's I graduated in December 2007. So you could kind of, the first sort of CMBS auction failed and some sort of things were going on. And, you know, so got a job at a multifamily development company up in Minnesota. And that's where I had a really fortunate, we'll call it break career-wise. You know, I had told this story, you know, to everyone I knew about the deals I had done. And so sort of, I mean, in a way I made my own luck with, you know, having done all of the stuff leading up to this. But one of my coworkers there, he was like, why don't we go talk to my dad? You know, he has money that he could invest in real estate. He has one building now that his business is in. Maybe like the three of us could buy some stuff together. So I don't like to waste time. We met with them like the next day for lunch and I had deals printed out. Like, here's what we could do together. And they really liked the $3 million shopping center, which I was surprised by with the size. You know, I had printed out stuff that was $5 million, $3 million, down to $200,000 duplexes. I didn't really know what they wanted to do. And again, with my parents being teachers, it was surprising that someone was just like, yeah, $3 million. I can put the $600,000, the million down, whatever, what we need to do on this one. But we ended up actually forming a partnership, the three of us. And we bought one of the deals that I printed out in that meeting. And we went on to buy, you know, 20 or so deals together. We're still doing deals together now. We bought just over $100 million of property together, the three of us. And then, you know, sort of fast forward, the first six or so deals were in Minnesota. Then I relocated to the Chicago area for a different job. So I was still working full time, even though I had bought those. I had rentals on my own and I was formed this partnership. But I was doing all this nights and weekends, and on my lunch break, I was calling brokers and our lenders and getting the stuff all done still on the side. And then in 2011, quit my job. And then we started getting into multifamily, where at that point we were doing commercial deals, buying shopping centers that needed to be leased up, or industrial deals, buying deals from developers, you know, because there's a lot of distress in the market. So we were actually picking off some of the better deals. And feel free to interrupt me. I can keep going. But if, you know, so then we started doing deals in Chicago, and really all those were value add, but they didn't require a renovation necessarily. Some did, but most did not, where we would just buy them. The rents were below market. We'd raise the rents to market. Then we'd do a cash out refi and with the Freddie SBL program. And we did on those apartment deals, we did 12 in a row of full on average cash out refinances of 100% or more of the equity. I think the percent's like 107% on average, pulling it out in a year or so's time. So, and just all around the city in like the better neighborhoods, Lincoln Park, Lakeview, North Center, Logan Square, Wicker Park.
And what were the sizes of those deals in those neighborhoods, Drew?
Yeah, $1.5 million on up to $6 million were the sizes we were buying. And so in Chicago, that'll get you between 6 units and 20 units on the north side. So to your point, what you were making earlier when we were starting, Dan, was the price per unit is high in Chicago. So a lot of people see that as a negative. But one thing that is nice about it is you can make a lot of money, have a lot of like dollars at work, and not be having that much of a management burden. You know, I've bought an 8-unit for $3.25 million, and then we raised the rents what they should be, and it appraised for $4 million. I mean, to do that in some of these other cities, you'd have to buy like a 40-unit to do that. You know,
raise 40 tenants worth of rent. It's like a much heavier lift than what.
Yeah, or maybe renovate the whole property. Where this, we didn't need to do anything. We bought it from somebody who they had built it. Then they it went through a foreclosure. Someone else bought it. They did not manage the deal aggressively, let's say, from a rental rate standpoint. They made a lot of money just buying it cheaply from the lender. And then we pick it up, and then we raise the rents to what they should be. We owned another 2-8 units just like it, sort of around the corner. And so as we did more deals, we kept doing the same type where it didn't need a renovation, but it needed the rents were just below market, and significantly below market. Whether typically we're buying from developers that did not maximize their lease up, like they leased it up in the winter. There's a lot of seasonality in the rental market in Chicago.
Yes, there is.
So then you buy a new deal that maybe leased out in December. You can get all those leases to end in, you know, May, June, July. You potentially can raise your rents just on that just on the timing difference, you know, 15%. There's a big discount in the winter on these really nice units. So yeah, I think on average, the deals we've sold, our IRRs have been 25% on average across a 5-year hold. So the deals that we did have gone really well in Chicago and in Minnesota, and then got hooked up with another family, similar deal, a father, and this time a son-in-law, or father-in-law, son-in-law. And we did about a similar amount of deals together, about $100 million, 2019, 2020, 2021. We bought our largest deal, or largest deal that I've done so far, at the end of 2020. So it's sort of peak COVID, if you will, in Chicago. Closed on it in October 2020, got started in the summer. In the West Loop, a 72 unit new building built in like 2015. So, new building, class A, really nice, but we had to assume their loan. So, you know, we bought it off market, was sort of shot by like a local broker, but not like widely. And then we just jumped on it quickly and got it at the right price. And that's been a really good deal for us. So, and then sort of fast forward to today, you know, I looked at sort of all the deals we had done, and they all went well, but it was, I wasn't really benefiting from any tailwinds or trends. You know, you're buying in Chicago, you have, maybe the north side is holding the population where it's flat to slightly increasing, the north side of the city. But then this, you know, overall the Chicagoland area, it's losing people or flat depending on the year. Minnesota's, you know, not much better, where it has a lot of like the taxes are high there. So they're losing a lot of folks to Florida and other states that, you know, have a better tax system, let's call it. So they're losing a lot of the high income residents and people that own the businesses in Minnesota. So we're, you know, while sort of fighting these headwinds, you know, the deals went well, but it was like, why not go where there's the tailwinds? You know, start doing deals in Arizona where its population's booming, and they have a 5% per year assessed value cap on how much your taxes can change. They have tax certainty for once, which I didn't have in Chicago. And then Texas, you know, that's obviously the number one every list for job growth, seemingly the Dallas Fort Worth area, you know, Texas as a whole. So that's what I did. So I moved to Austin, and also the last 5 deals I bought have all been in Phoenix, so in the surrounding suburbs. So
couple of things there I want to touch on. So as I hear you talk about your career and I think about my own, I just thought small for such a long time. We have a really sizable business and a great competitive advantage, and we are thinking big in that aspect, and have been for a long time. And I can credit my partners for, you know, bringing to the table and expecting something bigger than I might have done on my own, and I had to like live up to, grow into, and hopefully deliver enough to meet, or maybe even someday exceed the expectations I hope of my business partners. But when it came to rental properties, man, I just thought so small from the beginning. I was always afraid. My dad, part of how I got in real estate was my dad had 3 rental properties bought, you know, renovated, refinanced with no training, no books, none of that in 1987, 88, and 89. He ended up giving them up to one of the partners and kind of walking away as the economy shifted. And I remember being a little kid and we're going down there to collect the rent, and they're not paying, South Philly, not the South Philly that the Philadelphia listeners know today. This was when it was much, much, much different and challenging, we'll call it, right? Much higher crime, no gentrification going on in this area. So anyway, I was 9, 10 years old, maybe it was early 90, 91, somewhere in there. And it's like me and my younger brother and one of my sisters in the van. And he's like knocking on the door trying to collect the rent. And he's like pounding on the door trying to collect the rent. And no one's answering. He's obviously frustrated and kind of like, you know, things were not going well with his business. The economy was faltering. He's pounding even harder. He knocks so hard on one of those little diamond glass windows, those real old diamond glass windows in the wood, knocks so hard that the window breaks and his hand gets cut on the glass. So now dad's bleeding down his arm. And now the tenant yells from the upstairs window, "Hey, what are you doing? There's kids in here." And he's like, "I'm going to collect the rent." It was just this like great moment of confrontation that I saw in my childhood of like, oh my gosh, like the tenants are not going to pay the rent. So I think I attached, you know, to that fear, and it took me a long time to kind of get over that and start investing. I did not go to school for real estate like you did. And I think that I'm going to go out on a limb and assume or guess or posit that maybe doing the deals and studying these things at the age of 18, 19, 20, 21, like you did in going to school for real estate, gave you a much higher level of comfort with the larger numbers that you immediately got into. Because when I look at Westtown, I look at Lincoln Park, and I look at $2 and $3 million for 6 or 7 or 8 units or whatever they were, and that price per unit and those rents would scare the crap out of me, especially early on when I wouldn't have been able to cover any shortfall for the very large mortgage payments that were due. So much so I probably would not have showed up as prepared for the conversation that you did with your friend's father, and picked out a $3, $5 million and a $200,000 deal. Like I would have showed up for that meeting with like $90,000 single family rentals and thought it was like the greatest thing, because that would have been where my comfort level was. So the question I'll ask with that packaging is, you know, if we had a younger person or even someone who wasn't younger but was considering a real estate degree, how impactful is that long term? Would you suggest taking that 2, 3, 4 years and investing it in that space if somebody had the long term vision to want to do, you know, the $5, $10, $20 million deals that we're going to start talking about in a moment? Is that important? Would you recommend that to somebody who's, you know, considering that?
Well, I think I guess it sort of depends. So if you're already, if you're gonna, like, college is still important. So I don't want to say like everyone should not go to college. For me, like I already, a lot of the stuff that I was learning in school, I had, believe it or not, learned it on the streets, so to speak, already like 6 months prior. And then we're doing like an appraisal class and the teacher asked me like, "What are you seeing out there for cap rates in Madison, Drew?" Because I'm the only person doing deals. She's not, none of the other kids are. So I would say, would it be worth stopping what you're doing if you already have a career, go get the degree? I would say probably not. But if you're already going to college, like, of course, like I think it's important to have something to fall back on. And college is, I mean, honestly useful just to learn how to be an adult. So this is maybe a different answer than you're thinking where I go with it. But it's like, I think, you know, college is still worth it at these places where it's not like the 10th best private school for $50,000 a year in the state. Like those schools, I think I'm worried about if the value's there. But I mean, for what I did, going to a in-state public school, paying the in-state tuition and then getting a real estate degree, definitely worth it. I would have wanted to get a college degree anyways. And then I think if you were going to do it as an adult, you already have a degree. I would only think it would be worth it if you have something where it's a degree totally unrelated and you need that sort of credential to make the pivot, where if no one's going to take you seriously because you have, we'll pick on art, you know, an art degree or something, and now you're doing deals. Like, yeah, sure, if you get a master's degree in real estate from Madison, then maybe they look at you different. So it's more about the credential, I think, and the network, more than the education, though.
So. And I think it probably does help, right? It's like you showed up and you were going to school for real estate. And so this kid's dad, was he also in school for real estate with you at the time?
He was a year or two younger than me, the son. But so, and what's crazy in retrospect is, so I mean, I was probably 23 years old, but I look, or 22. I mean, but I seemed probably a lot older than his son, let's say. Like I was working full time. So I was like his boss. He was an intern there.
Okay.
And so I already graduated. I'm working full time in real estate. Granted, it is like for 6 months, you know, only, but it was, so I'm already full time, kind of like this guy's boss, you know, one of the many people that he would help as an intern. And then the main thing though, was I already had done four deals on my own. So it wasn't like, hey, here's some idea I have, and if you want to put all your money in it, we could see if it works or not. Like, I already have four deals that went well. I mean, one of them I bought for $220 and sold for $270. Another one for $650, sold it for $780. And the idea wasn't short holds like that. And that was like both those deals I just kept for like a year. So I had like a track record and a good, I heard what he wanted. He wanted cash flow and newer buildings because he had a construction company. So he cared a lot about the physical condition and still does. And so I catered to that. Like, here's a deal that's full. We can buy it at a really attractive cap rate. 7-year leases on it. Verizon Wireless was one of the tenants. Brand new building. Like, that's what he wanted. So
nice.
But what's crazy hearing when you're asking about, you're saying you were thinking small back then, or maybe still are, to some extent. I feel like I'm still thinking small, which is funny because I see people that are younger than me and they're buying, you know, $40, $50 million deals, you know, like, hey, I have this, you know, network of investors I throw it to, or I got this partnership with this family office, and they're, you know, I know someone who's my age. He has a $2 billion industrial portfolio in Texas. You know, I have 200 million. And so, I mean, that's more than I thought I'd ever own. But it's funny to think, you know, like really the levels to this where, you know, he probably, if you asked him, he's like, I wouldn't touch something under 30 million. It's not worth everyone's time. You know, if you asked him now, you know, so, even I thought I was kind of thinking too small, for a while, because what I did was I stayed, the deals were going well, so I didn't see it. I didn't really want to change it. And this is the money that the father had to invest. We just only deployed his money, reinvesting it for 10 years from 2008 to 2019. I guess it's 11 years, pretty much. Like, that's all we were doing, was just reinvesting the same money and just building that portfolio. And so most of the deals we did were always still in that $2-3 million range. Sometimes we bought something for 4 or 5 or 6, but we didn't make any big jump ups. And then that next family that I met, I showed them like, hey, the best deal I see right now is a $45 million deal, $15 million down. And he was like, all right, like, if like that, these numbers are good and I see what you've done. Like, he wasn't afraid of that and had the money, whereas it really a substantial guy, the second investor that I picked up. And so that was, you know, just again, another sort of like, whatever your mentality is at that point, really kind of blew it open, where it's like, geez, this guy, you know, you show him a $40 million deal and he's like, sounds good, let's roll, you know, like that was really, and now after I bought the bigger deal with that other family, then going back to the one where I was limiting us to the two and the three and whatever $1 million deals, since then we bought a couple deals each for 9, you know, like, so now we stepped up in size and I'm not afraid to show them like a bigger deal now as well. So
where do you land on the spectrum of hold forever versus sell everything at that 5-year deadline, because we need that cash out? Where do you land on that? You know, Warren Buffett, right? Intelligent investor. I don't really remember all the philosophies there. It's amazing that you read that at such a young age. I got about halfway through that and didn't make it much farther. But Warren Buffett says the best hold time is forever. So, like, where do you land on that spectrum, Drew?
I agree with that, where if it was just all my own money, I would buy deals and I would only sell them. And if I thought that it was like just turned into a waste of time size wise, or I really did not like the prospects of it going forward. So let's say some of the commercial deals we've sold where it was maybe 70% full when we bought it. We finally get it up to 100% occupancy. It worked at the numbers we had at 70%. Like the returns were fine if we never filled it all the way to 100. But then we get it to 100 and we're surprised we actually got it all the way leased. And we feel like the rents are high and we're like, man, maybe we need to think about selling this. We'll lose a tenant and we'll be kind of right back where we were with, and it'll be worth less. Like, so are we sort of at like a peak value that we might not get back to for a long time, which is more applicable in the commercial deals where those are really, so I own four shopping centers, one industrial deal, and then the rest is all apartments. So 25 or so apartment deals from there. And like the apartment deals, I don't think like that, like, oh, it's topped out or anything. But these commercial deals, it's kind of fickle where it's like you finally get them full. If you lose a tenant, you got to add a lot of money back in or could be empty for a year. And so then every time you get it full, you really need to think about selling. But no, I think if I would hold very long term until it's a waste of time in your mind, like this is too small. And that's sort of, recently I sold a 5-unit earlier this year in Chicago. And at the time when I bought it, it was like, I was excited about the deal. I bought it for like a $1.2 million. I assumed this guy's loan. I bought it directly from actually a lender that I knew or a deal he had bought. At that point when I bought it, I was excited about a deal that's $1 million. And then now that seems like it's not as good of use of time if I can go and buy a $20 million deal. So then in part, I thought that it just made sense to sell almost from like a time usage standpoint and then take the money and get it into the next deal that we buy, the next larger one. And if people, if you need money to buy the next deal, I mean, ideally you're doing these deals where you're creating value. And so just like what we were doing with the Chicago deals I was talking about, where we'd buy it, then we'd refinance out all our money. Now we just have our profits left in it. And we haven't paid any taxes yet in terms of capital gains or anything, because we didn't sell anything. We just borrowed more money, which isn't a taxable event. So I'd much rather just buy, raise the value, and refi some money out. If I need more money to deploy. If you don't need more money, then don't lever it up more, just cash flow it. But yeah, I'd much more, I'd advise that if it was all my money. That's why I said I would do that, is because sometimes we're selling and it's like a 5-year hold, like you're talking about, because we might have a dozen investors in some of our newer deals or whatever it is. And then, everyone's got a different sort of life timeline. But yeah, with these two families I've worked with, where it was really just one of them investing in a deal plus me putting in some money. Yeah, a lot of those deals we've owned for over 10 years and we plan on owning for a long time. Some of those early deals I was talking about, like that shopping center we bought in that first meeting in 2008, like we still own that and we're not planning on selling that anytime soon. Nice. We've already 4x'd our money on that deal actually without selling it, just in terms of cash flow and then a refi we did. So
sweet. Yeah, there's something to the forever compounding, and I have a handful of assets that I would love to sell. And I think the reason I'm probably not going to is because it's a little bit of a hassle for me to then try to sell it. So it's like the lesser thing to just kind of keep it sitting there than selling it. But I might have to bite the bullet and get rid of a few of those smaller ones that were so exciting and, when I got a few years back.
Yeah, because what's your thought on that, where you're more of a long-term hold?
I am, yeah. So for me, it's like, cost segregation on the front end to minimize my taxes on the income. Obviously, our main business is doing well. So my, problem of privilege is to keep investing the income that comes in from that. So for me, it's like I just want it to compound as long as it possibly can without having to create the taxable event. But I think I'm running into the same thing where I'm just now like going to the next level, let's say in the commercial, buying industrial properties. We're looking for 40 to 100,000 square foot industrial buildings, flex spaces, things of that nature. If I could find it with 70 or 80% occupancy and ideally with low rents, like I'm in, I want that. Right. And as I'm doing the numbers and we're closing on those, it's a lot more exciting and it's moving the needle. a lot further, a lot faster for the same lift, if you will, on the transaction closing time effort needed, right? So it's kind of the same effort. It's a little more of the skill. Yeah, it's a little more risk to get that deal to the settlement table. But if you're talking about loan, it's the loan documents. It's the application for the loan. It's going to sign off on the loan. It's, you know, arranging for the appraisal. You're going to have all that same stuff on, I don't know, $600,000-$800,000 building that you're going to have on a $4, $5, $6, or $7 million purchase. And you're already probably aware of that. And I assume that it's probably the same lift if we were dealing with $25 or $35 million. I mean, maybe it's a few more phone calls, but it sounds like you have a call with an investor and you're raising $1 million and he says, yeah, let's do it. And you have a call with another investor and you say, all right, it's going to be $9 million. He says, yeah, let's do it. And it was essentially the same 45-minute maybe phone call, maybe even less. Maybe the guy with more money is more busy and he only gave you 20 minutes to get your pitch done. I don't know.
Yeah. No, yeah, both of them are really great. But the guy with more money, he's very high level. So he's fun to deal with because if he likes the big picture on it, he's just trusts you. Hey, you said this is the best deal. Let me look at the numbers. Okay, let's go. But yeah, I think you're right. It's not the bigger deals. They're more work, but it's not like, you know, in proportion to the dollar amount, like you're saying, like buying a $30 million deal isn't 100 times more work than buying a $300,000 deal. You know, it's a lot, it's more work, but it's not like, one for one. The deals are harder. Some of these bigger deals that we've done have been, we get them closed. I'm like, oh, it was in a kind of an accomplishment to getting that one done. Like it was tricky or, you know, complicated. But yeah, I think you're right. And yeah, I think you'll know, like once you kind of feel like, okay, I'm working on this industrial deal, getting it closed, and you get a call about one of your rental houses and you're like, okay, maybe I don't, this time to not own this one or, you know, whatever, find a, you know, someone who can be in the middle. You know, I have an asset manager who works for me now, who's like the front line of defense with the property managers. So he can handle like, I'd say 80% of the stuff that comes in.
Nice.
So that's been a big time saver.
That's going to be something I wrote down as a hire at some point. So one of the things I want to touch on, personality trait, habit, I wrote it down for myself as much as I wrote it down for people on my team. I'm thinking it's something that probably sounds self-helpish a little bit, but I wrote it down in all capital letters, prepared. You were prepared for the meeting on that first investor with multiple different deals. You spent the time preparing, right? You did all that work ahead of time. Obviously, you were excited about the meeting and everything like that. I'm wondering, two parents as teachers and, you know, reading books that most people are reading at older ages in your high school years, really cool, right? So I'm like buying and selling like dirt bikes and motorcycles and car stereo equipment. And I remember doing that and I would sell it in this little newspaper called Sell It. It was like you post an ad and I'm like running ads and stuff. And it never amounted to the volume that you were able to sort of build your momentum early on. I had fits and starts for a long time before I came very, very consistent and focused at the age of about 32 on. Now I'm like 43. But the preparedness as a character trait, where did that come from? Was that something you saw in your parents? Was that drilled into you as a youth? Where did you come up with that? I don't know. That was a real skill set because you're preparing by reading all the books. You're preparing by finding the deals. You're preparing by selecting real estate going into college, which I've had conversations with people going into college a lot in the last couple of years, especially as my daughter went in and they don't know what they want to do. And they just don't really have the same direction, changing majors, that kind of thing. This is, we never really sat down and prepared maybe early enough in those situations to make the course corrected decisions really early on, which it seems like you did.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, looking back on it, and I would say, I always think I was like that. Where, you know, in school, I'd end up overstudying maybe for tests. We'll call it. I mean, or I was studying more. If you were like, how many minutes are people studying? I bet I was studying more than most. You know, but I guess just like My mom definitely like is super organized and prepared for stuff. Like, you know, if she's going to go to like a doctor's appointment, my parents retired now. So a modern example would be, you know, if they're going to go to a doctor's appointment, you know, my mom would be there with like questions and, you know, already looked into everything. So yeah, I'd have to chalk it up to her if I had to point to something, but I just somehow was always like that. And it's interesting looking back on, because you could, if I told you this, my like career in 30 seconds, you'd probably assume like, oh, you just got like lucky. This was your neighbor or somebody and you threw in all the money. Right. But like, what's interesting when I think back on it is like, wow, we really created that. I really created that luck where I bought the deals. I just saw. And then when I met them, like the guy that I partnered with, Brian, he also was majoring in real estate. I didn't meet him at school because he was a year or two behind me. He also was working at this company where everyone else was doing real estate. But like, why me? And it's like, well, because I was the one doing the deals, talking about them. And then, you know, maybe he said like, maybe we should do something with my dad to somebody else. I never asked them. Maybe they came there, they had a little chat and then nothing happened. Like, I don't work like that. So I'm ready to do business. So yeah, this was always like that, but it was, you know, and I think those early deals too, when you think about mindset, something that I've thought about where I never was worried about like those first deals. Like I thought I have the money, it's my money. I want to buy these properties. So I'll buy them. Like there wasn't any, I didn't have any hangups, like, can I do it or what will happen? I'm much more cautious, let's say, is with investors' money, where I don't feel like I should be learning on their investment dollars, but this was all my own money. So I thought like worst case, like I will just make sure I'm buying a property that's cash flow positive. And if I overpay, like let's say I don't understand how cap rates or gross rent multiplier works and I screw that all up, I'll just have to hold on to it and just, you know, pay the loan down and cash flow it out. And eventually it'll be worth what I overpaid, but I didn't overpay. It was as simple as I thought. And yeah, I think a lot of this stuff, when you look at like the people that are doing real estate or any business, like some of them are really, you know, exceptional, like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and all these people, like, yeah, they went to Harvard and they, you know, drop out. They don't even need Harvard. They're just ready to go with a genius idea and can execute it. But I mean, a lot of these people that do stuff, it's like, they're just regular guys and gals and they just went for it. Like they took the risk and they did it is like the big difference. So yeah, I was always prepared, but then I think, also willing to put in the work and then actually do it is actually what I had thought about, like thinking back on it. So it's interesting, the prepared comment. I've never had anyone say that actually, like where'd that come from?
So. Yeah, I mean, luck is when preparedness meets opportunity. And I find myself being more like your mom these days at 43 years old, where, you know, I am preparing for the doctor and I'm reviewing my own lab results and I'm making sure I get them back from the doctor. And like, I had to develop this like desire and hunger and like advanced thought process for whatever the next thing is that is coming up. And a lot of my stuff in my life now is like that. And people would probably say I'm obsessed and it's, you know, a little overboard, but hey, preparedness is when, luck is when preparedness meets opportunity. Drew, I have one more big topic before we get to the wrap up that I want to pull apart with you if we could. So yeah. I invest in deals. Let's live talk through what a deal might look like for me as an investor in one of your future projects. So here I am. I'm not going to be the guy that's going to write you the $9 million check. I'm probably one of the 12 investors who's going to throw some money into the pot for the next project. So with that context, what does that look like for me as an investor in your deal?
Right. And yeah, in 2021, we sort of rearranged the business of sorts to focus on these Sunbelt markets and then also to take on individual investors like what you're talking about, where from until that point, I had just only had those two investors and they were never in the same deal. It was always separate deals too. Like one works for one guy, one works for the other. But then sort of like I would have people that I knew who would say, hey, I could invest $100,000 or $50,000 or $200,000 in a deal. Like, what could we do? And I actually just tell them, like, I'm not set up for this. Like, I don't have investor reporting. Like, they're just in our accounting. Like, they're basically partners. Like, there's no reporting. I don't have a pitch deck, really. Like, I just send them the model and we go to the property. Like, there's not. So we had to change things up. So now we're set up to take on what you're talking about, individual investors. So where we redid our website and got an investor portal now. So we're set up for that. And we've been, syndicating deals like you're talking about. And yeah, multifamily deals today. So we specialize in just multifamily and only in Phoenix, Dallas, and Austin, Texas. So why those markets? It's because those are doing, are some of the fastest growing parts of the country. And then also, Dallas is such a big economic engine, as well as Austin. Austin is number one for population growth and job growth in the country, as a percentage, so not in raw numbers, but for a city its size. And then Phoenix just always been growing fast for a long time. So we focus on those markets. I know I'd mentioned it before, but Phoenix too, it has a 5% per year assessed value cap. So you have really good tax certainty. And the taxes are low there. I have a $30 million deal in Phoenix and my taxes are $38,500 on that deal. And then I have a $30 million deal. Yeah. And I have the $33 million deal in Chicago I was talking about. Our taxes on that are $525,000 a year.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. And so, So Arizona's got it right for taxes. And then same thing with insurance, where there's the insurance growth is not fairly stable there because there's not any big like loss. There's no tornadoes or hurricanes or floods or anything. It's just hot, but that doesn't create any, an insurance loss being hot. So we're just in those markets, and then we just do certain types of multifamily. So what I focus on now is I want to buy a property that I can create value with. So force the appreciation of the property. So we're looking for deals that are five to call it $30 million deals that we can take and then make worth more. And what we try to do is get it to on a cap rate basis. Let's say if we want the untrended yield on cost is a term that is used for this, but our stabilized cap rate, we'll call it as well. So either term, stabilized cap rate, untrended yield on cost, to be 1% higher than what like the going cap rate is in the market. So if it's a 5.0 cap rate market, we're only buying deals that stabilize to a 6 or higher. And why we're using the cap rate and untrended yield on cost is that's how most investors are looking at the deal. On a cap rate basis, if you don't use those terms, just to keep it simpler, it's like we're creating with our business plan 15 to 25 or 30% of value doing our renovation or resetting the rents to market if it doesn't need a renovation. But we're generally, our business is not like, oh, we just bought it a little bit cheaper than it should have sold for. Or we're just buying it to buy any deal in Dallas because like that's the best market. Like we do think those are the best markets.
How difficult has this buy structure with a 1% higher than the going cap rate, untrended yield on cost? How have you dealt with that in the last 6 to 12 months? As I imagine, we've seen at least 1% change in cap rate in the markets that you're looking at. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, you're right. So the deals that, and this is also why you're... it's important to be buying value add deals, is the deals we bought in 2021. And, we buy them at one cap rate. Then we do our business plan. We stabilize them higher, but then also, cap rates increase. So then the values drop in the face of that. But then a lot of that value decrease was offset by our business plan adding value to the property. So we like that from that angle, where if you have a market pullback, you're offsetting some of it or all of it with your business plan. But it's been really hard though, to answer your question. The last year, the last property we bought was, would have been put under contract in May of 2022. And we were doing a 1031 exchange from two smaller deals we sold, roll them up into a bigger one, close that in July, 2022. And that one was just with money we already had. And so, the last syndication we did, that would have been January 2022. So, it's going on, because you don't want to, if rents are, in some of these places around the country, rents have been flat or falling, cap rates are increasing, interest rates are increasing. So, to me, that's a good time to, we're still looking at deals, but if you can't still get that, you know, premium that you need with your business plan, when you adjust to the new cap rate, you shouldn't buy. So, you know, it hasn't worked because sellers are holding on to the old prices, or they're not selling at all. But I mean, over the next couple of years, there's going to be a lot of deals in the market where people, they maybe bought it in 2020, 2021. They did a 3-year loan. They don't want to refi at these higher rates, or if they did, they'd have to add money to it, and they don't want it. The people that don't want to do that will have to sell. And then that's going to be a good buying opportunity. And that's coming, you know, the next, call it, you know, 3 months to 2 years, that'll be happening.
Yeah, so. I think you're right about that. So let's peel that apart. Do you guys do like 50-50 split with the partner, pref returns? To my 100 grand is going in the next deal that we find in the next 9 months, let's say. What are my returns looking like? What does that partnership structure syndication look like?
Yeah, so on these, today with where interest rates are, there's not a lot of cash flow on these deals, or in the market in general. So typically, you know, if we're renovating a property, there's no cash flow during that time. And then once we're done with the renovation, you know, the cash flow is, you know, call it 5% a year to the investors. And that's not, it's not as exciting as how it used to be. You know, we used to be passing on deals where, oh, it's only a 9% cash on cash, let's not do it. You know, where those days are long gone for the, as long as interest rates are high, because you really, your cash flow is your spread between what would this property make if we had no debt on it, from like a percentage yield standpoint, and how you're borrowing. If you're, the deal makes 5% if you had no debt on it, and then you're borrowing at 5%, like there's no spread, you're not generating a lot of cash flow. And so, you know, the deals though, what we're looking at was, we're trying to find a 15% internal rate of return deal level. And then over a 5-year hold, typically that's going to be a 2x equity multiple. And then our fee structure is a 1% acquisition fee. And then we have, you know, our incentive fee, how that's set up is there's an 8% preferred return. And then after the preferred return is paid and all capital is returned, all the investor capital, we start splitting 70-30 with the investors. So then the investors would get 70 and we would get 30% of the profits from there. And then if from there it exceeds a 12% IRR, then we're splitting 50-50. So, but typically all those splits, yeah, on the remainder, all those splits, any of that's really just on sale, because nowadays you're not able to do large cash out refinances until rates drop. Let's say if the rates drop and you've done your business plan, raised the building value, you can pull out money. But yeah, typically so that's all sort of done on sale. So it's sort of more or less like the investors get all the cash flow while we own it, because they're getting the 8% preferred return. And then if that's not paid, the preferred return that accrues. So then they'll get it when it's available. So it's not, you don't lose it. So that's how it works. And that's, you know, I think the best place to be in the market right now, because you know, if you are buying stabilized deals that don't have any value add, I mean, you definitely need to trade up in quality right now and buy nicer stuff. But, you know, if you're just buying a deal at the prevailing price, you're not getting like any better return than just the market. Like you're just getting whatever the market's going to make, and maybe that's going to be flat or down. Whereas with these deals we buy, we already have a going in plan where we're going to be able to create equity and then in turn have higher returns because of that than the, you know, just your average deal in the market.
Nice. Yeah. And I imagine, like you said, the buying opportunities that will come, there's probably going to have to be some workouts done with a lot of that first mortgage that is probably underwater with some of those lenders. Challenging market, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, like I tell, you know, when I say, a lot of times I don't lead with what my track record is, because it's, you can't make those returns today. So I don't want to be misleading, where our average returns are 25% IRRs. And, you know, we're in, it's a way better than 15, obviously, but that's, we spend all year looking for 15% returns and can barely, you know, haven't found any in a year. So I wouldn't, you know, what happened before was you buy it, you think, okay, I'm going to run this business plan. Maybe it's a 15 to 20% IRR. And then the market would surprise you, like, oh, cap rates dropped and rents went up more. You know, right now, you know, we buy, yeah, maybe we'll beat these numbers where, yeah, we're not assuming interest rates drop or rents explode. We're sort of just assuming things sort of stay how they are when we underwrite. So we have like the ability to like outperform, but yeah, that's where the market's at now. And so it's not as exciting, let's say, as what it was, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago, but compared to the alternatives, like I really still like it, you know, for the individual investor, whether you want to invest passively in like a deal of ours or just buy something on your own and, you know, hire a management company and run it. I mean, real estate still makes a lot of sense today where you, even if you're getting a, you know, call it a 12 to 15% return. I mean, that's still, in my opinion, for the risk involved. Like I like that a lot more than the stock market, where real estate is less risky than the stock market and has higher returns. So the negative though is your money's tied up. It's illiquid. So it's not like you can just press a button and get your money out. So that's the big negative with real estate. But compared to the alternatives, I really like it. And I got, you know, I'd have to count it up, but probably 98% of my, you know, my net worth is all in real estate. And I just have the rest waiting to go into the next deal. So.
Yeah, that makes two of us. We're at this unique position in the marketplace. We are all expecting this. I don't know, there's going to be like a tsunami of workouts. I mean, there's probably, I think when I was doing some math with another mentor of mine, it was like 10 to 15% of these loans were going to come due. Maybe half of those are in a position not to add capital and turn into a truly distressed situation. And I don't know. Same mentor was commenting, I don't know that it's going to be like the savings and loan crisis where that was a literal tsunami of commercial assets that came through. And we saw a lot more even maybe come through after the 08 debacle. So if the economy shifts and the job losses mount and the rents do drop, you know, things could get much worse. On the flip side of that, we're sort of in this very odd time in human history where the interconnectedness and the news cycle and all of the cycles that occur are so fast. So I remember when 2008 occurred, I remember reading about, you know, the headlines and what was going on in Business Week and Fortune magazine. And these were like weekly or monthly periodicals. When Silicon Valley Bank collapsed, I remember reading about it, you know, on Google and on Facebook and on Twitter, and it all happened in an instant. And all of a sudden, it was like swept under the rug. And, you know, the government was able to act exponentially faster than in 2008. You know, it was like weeks. It felt like weeks and months as that unfolded. And then the $800 billion credit line was implemented, whereas it was over the weekend this time. So we have this like compression almost of the business cycle. Maybe I'm a complete fool and we're going to run into a 2 or 4 year downturn cycle. I mean, I don't know if you recall when the rates were going up, I think in what, 2017, 18 and 19.
Yeah. And nothing plummeted because of that. You know, I remember I did a couple of refis in 2018 and my rates were in the fives. Then they started dropping again. And then we're in back into the threes.
I mean, you know,
the thing that's really interesting now, comparing at least to the 2008, you know, the most recent stuff. I mean, at that point, especially on the smaller deals, let's say, you know, 1 to 4 units, everyone was doing 5 year or 3 year ARMs, where the rates were not good. They were like, you know, adjustable rate mortgages where you start out with like a teaser rate. Yeah, I've been paying 5% for the first 3 years, and then it jumps to like 9%. So yeah, they could only afford the low rate. And some had negative amortizing loans where, yeah, the rate the whole time is 9%, but then you just pay like it's 3% and we'll tack it on to the principal balance. So we really didn't have like a lot of that. You know, people were picking, you know, 30-year fix this go around. They're putting in real down payments. There wasn't as much no money down stuff. People were still selecting ARMs, but they weren't this would seem way more punitive back then, where it was like, okay, you can the spread. People were, I don't know if they just didn't pay attention to it or what. Like once it starts adjusting, I guess they thought they would just refi, and then all of a sudden you couldn't. Where now this go around, I think people were picking lengths of fixed rate terms where they thought they'd be in it. Like I bought a house in 2017. I've already sold it now, but we picked a 7 year ARM and we're like, I will even be in this thing for 7 years. And we weren't. So, I don't know, just yeah, seems a lot more healthy right now than 2008, and definitely than the 80s, from what I had heard, where people were just building stuff that didn't even make sense financially, but somehow you could get the enough tax losses where you still made money even if the deal didn't. And two, like the I think I don't remember the stat exactly, but it was something to this effect where it was, you know, something like 80% of all mortgages have a rate below 4% right now, you know, on homes. So it was, you know, something in that neighborhood. Maybe it was 2/3 below 3 and something, but it was, you know, it was, it's hard to imagine a lot of like distress if all people need to do is like, hey, just don't do anything. Just like stay home and pay your 3% mortgage. And, you know, you need, I guess, to have a lot of job losses, would be the thing. Cause before, people were just in really bad financing products. And then it was just a cascade of prices falling and people overbuilding. You know, most of the stuff being done on the commercial side is, yeah, people doing bridge debt and building condos and stuff that weren't going to, that had no buyers for it, where there wasn't like a big condo boom this go around. So,
yeah. And I mean, in this day and age where we're at now compared to 2008, with the rise of the gig economy, you know, Uber, those type of things, it's like if someone's in a jam in one of my apartment units in Chicago, in theory, they could go out and drive Uber for the weekend and they can make up the $300 or $400 or $500 shortfall. They could do it all week long and cover the rent, right? So there's like more access to opportunity this time, which potentially I think could kind of help the economy at large stay somewhat liquid. Whereas in 1980, there certainly wasn't. In 2008, there was a lot less. I think it's a lot more normalized now where people have options to be able to go out and make up shortfalls that simply didn't exist, you know, 10.
Yeah, that's interesting. I keep always coming back to the lending side, you know, that's where, but yeah, because I haven't thought about that. I just keep thinking like, well, in 2008 and 1988 or 87, like whatever that was, there was the lending just totally stopped. Like there was no, you know, half the, you know, all the savings and loans went under. So they're not lending, obviously, if they're closed. And then, you know, everything stopped in 2008. And then that just created a you know, as things fall, it just keeps cascading downward. Yes, and we haven't had a stop in lending. We've had a slowdown, but at least especially in the multifamily stuff we look at, if anybody needs a loan, they just still can go to Freddie and Fannie. Both of those agencies, they do, you know, somewhere in the tune of like 70 or 80 billion of lending each. So that's one thing that's nice about multifamily is you have access to that, where the other types of properties like retail and hotels, yeah, industrial, you aren't using them.
Yeah, so it's 50% down right now or something if you can't get a loan. It's kind of tough.
Yeah.
Cool. So let's go with the crown jewel of wisdom if we could, Drew. Okay. So you were a young guy. You were starting off really early. You're getting ready to walk into the meeting with your buddy Brian, your partner Brian's father. And you're already prepared, but now you know a lot more. If you could go back and share the crown jewel of wisdom with yourself the night before that meeting, what would it be?
Yeah, I think I would be telling myself, like, you have everything already that you need to do this. Like, there's no difference between the people buying these deals and the three of you guys. One guy's got the money, and then the other two good people know how to do it. Like, you got it. So that would be what I'd be telling myself. And to be honest, that's what I was thinking. That's why we did it. So, nice. I mean, yeah, that's, you know, cause it's, and that's where too, when you're talking about the confidence early on, like I was more confident having a really strong, partner financially, where that gave, you know, not that we would be taking, where I wasn't taking chances we shouldn't have been taking, but it was not where now I'm not making an investment because like I'm too scared of the downside and I can't take advantage of the upside, if that makes sense. Where collectively the three of us, if something, you know, happened, we could weather the storm with him involved. So that did also make us more confident. I just thought of that. But not overconfident where we're just making gambles we shouldn't, but not where we're saying, hey, this is a good deal, but I can't do it because it's my last dollars, or if we lose that tenant, I don't have the money. Where the three, we could have gone back to him.
Nice. Where can listeners get more information about you and your companies?
Yeah, so best place to go is Brenneman.com. So B as in boy, R-E-N-E-M-A-N. brennemancapital.com. That's the company for Brenneman Capital, our firm. And so you can learn about our company there, our portfolio, the deals we do. You can sign up to be on our investor list, or you can sign up to be on our newsletter. We also have a guidebook on how to how it works investing passively in real estate that you can also download on our website in the download section. And then I guess lastly, I also have a podcast. It's called The Brenneman Blueprint. It's a real estate investing podcast. It's on every podcast platform and YouTube. It used to be, it started out more Chicago focused, let's say, but then as I started doing deals in the Sun Belt, it sort of just shifted to just all, you know, active real estate investment stuff. And then sometimes I do some episodes for passive investors, just sort of solo, like here's how a 1031 works, or here's some like red flags to look out for, or how to vet a sponsor. And then I guess I'm also everywhere on social media, just at Drew Brenneman. So you can find me wherever you want. I'm all over. So
cool. My final question, what is the kindest thing anyone has ever done for you, Drew?
Yeah. And I think, you know, we talk so much about this, the first partnership I had. And I think, I mean, there's been a lot of, you know, great things that have happened in my life, but it's certainly in a business context, like the father in this initial partnership, has been really great to work with. And, you know, first early on, you know, he could have just dictated probably any terms we would have taken them. You know, we're just trying to get our careers going. And, sometimes you see that where people are, overhanded, if you will, like overplaying like their strength in a business deal. And he never did that. And we worked out a deal we all liked and stuck with it. He didn't overplay the fact that was putting in the money. And so, you know, we haven't had to change anything with the deal structure in the 15 years we've been working, and it got, you know, still doing more deals together. So it worked out great for everybody, but that was definitely not, overdoing it. You know, sometimes you hear people saying I'm getting bent over a barrel or whatever on this deal. And, you know, I've never had to say that. So thankful for that.
Nice. Sounds like he was fair, and it really opened the door for you to get to the next level.
Yeah, it definitely was, you know, but not where it's like charitable, but where it was not, where we're not getting sort of wondering if we should even do it or something, you know. So it's been great for everybody.
Yeah, and I think that's key. I mean, as we wrap up, like finding partners whose interests are aligned is really important to me. I try to structure any of my partnerships so that we all feel like we're aligned, we're working toward the same goal, we're getting fair outcomes from all that. Not having the balance of the partnership where one person's effort is not correct, or the money is trying to take way too much off the table than perhaps it should, has been a sticking point for me. And I think that's the source of a lot of frustrations for a lot of partners. So it's really cool to hear you.
Yeah. And another thing that he never did that comes up a lot is where people they'll try to change things to the last second. I hear that all the time. Like your investor, let's say they're putting in all the money, or most of it, 95% of the equity, but from one party, you're buying the deal, you got your earnest money in already. And then they have the idea like, hey, I was thinking about this, and it's like a worse deal for you now. This is their idea. That's extremely common. I hear that all the time from my peers that have similar businesses and have, you know, are going to single check investors, where that it's just like a retrade towards the end to make it better for them. So kind of short-sighted, you know, if that's what you're doing, where then, you know, the person you're partnering with is, you know, almost despises you at that point and goes, says, fine, I'll continue it because the deal, we're already non-refundable on the earnest money, already doing it, but this is not like the partnership I wanted. I'm getting messed with here. So yeah, they never did that too. That's a common thing that I hear happening to folks I know.
Good stuff. Drew, I have tons of notes here. I really appreciate you taking the time. I know we went over what we would normally allocate for these episodes. I'm sure the listeners appreciate it, and I certainly do. So thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
The REI Diamond Show is sponsored by Diamond Equity Investments, a private equity firm focused on buying and selling residential and commercial property throughout the United States. If you are an accredited investor seeking double-digit returns, you can sign up to review Diamond Equity's passive investment opportunities at www.fundrehabdeals.com. And if you're an investor who is seeking deals that you can buy, fix, and flip, please go to www.dealswithroi.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.